A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on Sen. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display, I eventually had to go down to the cellar.
That's the display department.
With a torch. The lights are probably gone. So had the stairs.
Yours is number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 20. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television, and today we are talking about UFO. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon from England.
UFO was set in the future in the 1980s. UFOs are real aliens, and they are coming to Earth and abducting people. And they're doing this in some numbers, so Earth has its defense to protect against this. Commander Ed Straker leads the Supreme Headquarters Alien Defense Organization, or SHADOW. And SHADOW protects Earth from the aliens and tries to defeat them at every turn. It's also a secret organization that has spies and an underground complex and all sorts of things.
UFO was a 1970 television series produced by the independent TV company ITV in Britain, and it was produced by Gerry Anderson and his Century 21 production company, who are probably best known, and certainly were best known then, for the long-running sci-fi puppet shows that had gone right through the 60s, using what Gerry Anderson called super marionation. And they're probably the most famous ones are Thunderbirds and Captain Scarlet, although there were several others, including Joe 90 and Supercar. But probably I think Thunderbirds and Captain Scarlet were the most famous ones. And this was his first venture into live-action television, but he was sticking with science fiction. And so, as Brian says, he started off with this setup, which we get explained in the first episode of UFO, which is that UFOs are real, they're attacking people, they're abducting people. And after a UFO incident, we meet Commander Straker for the first time when he's quite a young chap. I think he's a young colonel in the American Air Force, and he's got important information about UFOs, and he's heading towards a international meeting when the car taking him to the meeting is actually attacked again by a UFO. Obviously, they were trying to stop him because, as we later find out, Straker had got plans to develop SHADOW. And then very quickly, we get the story running by jumping forward to, as Brian said, what was the future at that time. So we jump forward 10 years and find that SHADOW is up and running and Straker is in charge and defending the Earth.
And SHADOW is clearly a very high-budget organization, something that they address as the series goes on. But when we first see SHADOW at the beginning of the series, we find that the SHADOW headquarters is a large complex that is located beneath a film studio. So there's this movie studio, and Ed Straker is, as a cover job, acting as one of the owners and operators of this film studio. Deep below the studio is this underground complex that is the SHADOW headquarters.
And the base is quite fun because it, as you say, it's a film studio, which I think was quite useful for the production team because it meant they could reuse their own sets as sets for the actual show. In typical Gerry Anderson fashion, Straker's office, at press of a variety of secret buttons, Straker's office sinks down and takes him down to the underground secret base. This idea of buildings rising and falling and sinking, it's quite common in Gerry Anderson stuff. If you've seen Thunderbirds, you'll know he does it on Tracy Island, and it happens in Stingray, which is another one of his shows. And it's quite fun to see the base going down.
Yes, this is a very gadget-heavy series. And as we talk about later, in some ways, the gadgetry was often handled pretty well. It was also, in addition to being Gerry Anderson's first live-action series, I think it was his first series that was aimed at adults more than at children. There was some effect there in that I think he was still trying to figure out how to make a series that had some more adult-oriented content.
Yeah, there were certainly some adult themes as we go along, which did get the production team into some trouble as they went on.
Yes.
And I think it was broadcast. It certainly was broadcast much later in the day than his previous shows, which had all been very much aimed at children's sort of viewing times.
There were a variety of characters within SHADOW. We've mentioned Ed Straker already, who was played by Ed Bishop. And Straker was this character with very striking blonde hair, not his real hair, of course, but very striking blonde hair that gave him this very unusual look that some people say it was meant to mimic one of Gerry Anderson's super marionation characters. We also had Alec Freeman, who was like a right-hand man to Straker, and he was a little more freewheeling and a bit of a ladies' man, played by George Sewell. He felt at times like a little bit of a James Bond character, almost.
Yes, he does, yeah. Certainly when he's chatting up receptionists in a Bond and Miss Moneypenny style. And actually, later on in the series, we actually have Miss Moneypenny herself, Lois Maxwell, turns up just to complete the idea.
The Lois Maxwell character even makes the reference to the regular place where she works, suggesting James Bond and his organization. That was cute.
Yes, absolutely. There's a little in-joke goes on there. And there's another James Bond type character. I think they decided after the first few episodes that they wanted to introduce a slightly younger, more action man type character. So they introduced a pilot called Paul Foster, played by an actor, Michael Billington, who actually apparently had auditioned for the role of James Bond. And again, to keep the sort of Bond theme going, he's another very Bond-like action man who is used to get into a lot of the scrapes. He does a lot of the fighting. He pursues a lot of the romantic interests throughout the various episodes. He seems to have a lady friend in most ports, it would appear.
Yes, it does. Foster rapidly went from making his way into shadow a few episodes in into a rather major commanding role there.
Yes, he has a very rapid rise to the top of the organization. But I think they just wanted to introduce his character and they wanted to get him up on screen a lot of the time.
We also have a character called Gay Ellis, and she was one of the operatives on the moon base. We'll talk about the moon base more in a few minutes. She was the most featured of the women, all women, who are in the control room of moon base and have a very unusual look to them involving, well, purple wigs and excessive eye makeup. And we will talk about that more.
It's a fantastically distinctive look. And if you know, it's the first thing you'll see on the DVD covers usually is the purple wigs, the eye makeup and the shiny suits, which we'll go on to talk about. But yes, so there was Gay Ellis. And then there's another couple of characters that we'll come across. There was a pilot called Peter Carlin, who was played by an actor called Peter Gordino, who was actually, he was quite a popular dancer at the time. I think this was one of his only acting roles. And he was clearly sort of another one of the very sort of dishy ladies man types. He had a very distinctive look. If you know the singer Engelbert Humperdinck, think that sort of look with the big sideburns. He actually quit the show about halfway through the series because his agent didn't want him to get typecast. And there's also, I mean, there's several other characters, but there was Colonel Virginia Lake, who was played by an extremely classic, attractive 60s actress called Wanda Ventham, who cropped up in loads of television and film work in the 60s and 70s, had a very, very distinctive look with the big hair and everything. And she's actually introduced, I think, in the first episode, but then she came very much into her own towards the end of the series due to various details of the production, which we'll get into. So she's another interesting character.
There was something very outlandish about the look and the style of all of the characters in UFO. We mentioned that it was from 1970, and it was broadcast in about 1970, but production did start a little bit earlier, and most of it has very much a sort of late 60s kind of look to it.
It certainly is. It's very sort of, as you say, very glossy and almost camp now to watch it.
Yes. Almost absurd now to watch it at points.
It is. At points, it is very strange. I mean, as you say, there's an episode where they go to a very swinging 60s party, and it is quite ridiculous to watch it now. But there you go. It's certainly, you know, UFO as a series has got a very distinctive look to it.
The rapid aging isn't documented in the report. We're not sure why it happened, but it's certainly connected with the reaction of Earth's atmosphere on the body.
Now, gentlemen, let's concern ourselves with the three main questions regarding UFOs. One, where do they come from?
Now, the fact that the lungs were filled with an oxygenated liquid seems to indicate a subjection to phenomenal acceleration and fantastic speed over a long period, long enough for the skin to pick up the green coloration of the liquid.
So we mentioned the base. We mentioned Shadow's underground base with Straker's sinking office, which allows Straker and his team to sort of control all the various bases and vehicles, which we'll discuss, in their fight against the UFO ships that are attacking Earth. And from there, basically, Straker's controlling everything and calling the shots and ordering his various personnel and his various vehicles at his disposal into action.
They have the moon base, which is a rather major center of operations on the moon. The moon base acts as a major line of defense for the UFOs as they approach. It has defenses that it can launch and activate for UFOs to basically destroy them and take them down before they reach Earth. It's also a major settlement and location for Shadow. They seem to have a lot going on there, and we will talk more about some of the characters and how it's used, but most of the major characters show up on the moon base from time to time and are involved with those operations. They also have an orbital satellite called SID, the Space Intruder Detector, and it is basically a large computer and sensor system that detects UFOs as they approach. It is apparently their main way of discovering UFOs as they approach the Earth.
So we've got the basic idea that the UFOs are attacking Earth, and they're trying to get past Shadow's defenses to get to the Earth and abduct people. So we have the UFO ships themselves, which play a big part in just about every episode. And these were they're sort of flying saucers. They're sort of, if you think, spinning top or jelly mold-shaped craft, which are supposed to travel at ridiculous speeds. I mean, I think at some point they do mention that they are supposed to be exceeding the speed of light. So it's not terribly hard science fiction that's going on here. But anyway, so these spinning craft are attacking and usually seem to come past the moon on their attack run, where Moonbase will deploy Shadow's defense, which are some spacecraft called the Interceptors, which are great fun. They usually go up in a sort of squadron of three of these interceptor craft, and they have this rather ridiculously large single missile, one-shot missile attached to the front of the interceptor craft, which they will fire at the UFOs. And there's a couple of things that arise out of that. Because the missiles are one shot, if they miss, then it means that one of the UFO craft, at least one, is going to get through and get to Earth. Of course, as several people have pointed out, if they didn't miss once in a while, the actual TV show would not be terribly exciting, because each episode would consist of the UFOs being shot down. So in most episodes, at least one of the interceptor craft will miss. And like anything with Gerry Anderson, like Thunderbirds and Stingray and so on, these vehicles were available as toys and were very popular as toys. So you could get the Interceptor with its huge missile on the front, which in classic toy style would fire. Just going off topic slightly now, I know if you search eBay, you will see loads of Interceptor craft, but nearly none of them have got their missiles still intact. Most of the missiles have disappeared over the years.
The UFOs and Interceptors were a bit of an odd combination. It was like you had a pre-programmed scenario that happened over and over, because the UFOs would almost always approach in a group of three, and the three Interceptors would be launched. Depending on how many of the Interceptors were successful in shooting down a UFO, either they'd all be shot down, or one or two of them would make it further and get to Earth.
Yes, you think the aliens would have figured it out. If they can figure out faster than light travel, they should figure out, well, perhaps if we sent four ships, they only ever send up three interceptors, we'll be all right. One will always get through.
That's right.
And one inevitably does get through, or in most episodes, to Earth's atmosphere. So then we have to get another line of defense from Shadow.
That's right. And I think also in true Gerry Anderson style, you had Skydiver and Sky One. Skydiver was a submarine that could basically patrol anywhere in the Earth's oceans. And Sky One was an aircraft that was attached to the nose of Skydiver. So Skydiver looked like one big ship, and Sky One would launch off the nose of Skydiver while it was underwater and come out from the water and fly into the air, up into the upper atmosphere, and be able to shoot down one or more UFOs. And unlike the Interceptors, Sky One had lots of little missiles, so it was able to have many shots at a UFO or take down a number of UFOs.
Yes, it's basically, I mean, Sky One, if you've seen Thunderbird, Sky One is basically Thunderbird 4, but it can fly and it's attached to the front of a submarine, which fires it off. As you say, it looked fantastic with the model work and this thing shooting out of the water into the atmosphere. But if you thought about it, it didn't really make an awful lot of sense that they would have it underwater all the time, just waiting to deploy.
And they had one of them to patrol the entire Earth.
Although I think in later episodes, we get the idea that there are more than one submarine around.
Yes, that's true.
Because I think there's one episode where one gets destroyed. But anyway, yes, it does look, it looks fantastic. And of course, with Gerry Anderson, we've got this very detailed model work. And if you've seen any of his Super Marionation shows, if you've seen the original Thunderbirds, you'll know the sort of stuff we're talking about. And so the UFOs and the Interceptors and even the SID satellites. And of course, Skydiver and Sky One were all done with typical Gerry Anderson model work. And there was a variety of other vehicles as well. There was various shadow mobiles, which were sort of tank-like transporters that they used when the UFOs actually got to Earth and needed to be hunted down if they'd landed. Plus, there was various lunar vehicles, something called, I think it's called the Moon Bug or a Moon Hopper, that transports people across the surface of the moon. And also, I don't know if this expression was in terribly common use at the time, but there's a lunar shuttle. The personnel sort of transported between Earth and Moon Base on lunar shuttles. And just to complete the lineup of fabulous vehicles, when Straker and also Paul Foster are driving around in their sort of civilian lives, they have rather fantastic, sleek, futuristic, gull-winged cars, which look fabulous, which were apparently built by the production team. They were sort of built as kits on top of existing cars, and they have these huge gull-winged doors that open up, very much like the DeLorean in Back to the Future, except that I gather that the gull-winged doors on these particular cars didn't work, and so whenever the door opened, supposedly automatically, it was actually a stagehand just lifting the door up. And I think I'm right, there was a shot in one of the episodes where you can actually see the guy's arm holding the door up for the actor to step out.
The cars were actually sometimes referred to as shadow cars, and they were fairly outlandish looking, like everything else here. They had lots of gear inside them as well. They had sort of scanner type gear in them, and they had telephones built into them and all sorts of things. And it seemed like this shadow car was a particular thing that only the shadow operatives had. There were, I think, three different shadow cars that you'd usually see. And when you saw the parking lot of the film studio that hid the shadow headquarters, you would see these three shadow cars parked in the parking lot, which always seemed a little bit odd for a secret organization.
Yes, they weren't keeping that part very secret, were they? Because, you know, all the other characters that we see drive around in very ordinary 1970s-looking cars. And then there's these enormous, sleek, gull-wing vehicles, one of which is gold. There's a sort of pinky one. And I can't remember what colour the other one is, but they're very distinctive. And as you say, they look like they're in UFO. They're that same sort of 60s standout, almost psychedelic. And they go along with the very sort of sleek and high-concept design and look of UFO. As do all the costumes that the characters wear. Because again, it's quite funny, they've got this thing where it's 1970, but they're looking forward to 1980 and they're imagining what the fashions will be like in 1980. And so they've sort of extended from the late 1960s fashion. So the men wear very sort of sharp suits with, if you think of the Beatles Nero jackets with the turned up collars, there's a lot of men's tailoring like that in the show. There's also a rather regrettable amount of turtleneck sweaters and big pendants or amulets being worn by men.
And mock turtlenecks under suit jackets and things of that sort.
Yes, it's very, you know, again, it's very slick, and it looks like late 1960s Carnaby Street sort of fashion. It's almost, dare I say, it's almost Austin Powers in some respects.
Yes, it is. It's almost like you're wondering if these guys are going to some kind of fashion party or if they're there to work.
Yeah. And then, of course, when we get up on the moon, as you've said,
then we get to things that even leave the suits and turtlenecks behind, because we have the main control room of the moon base, which is generally operated exclusively by women for some reason. And they will have a crew of three women there, all three of them wearing these sort of mid-neck length purple wigs, bright purple wigs, for no reason that's explained. And in addition to the purple wigs, they have this sort of multicolored eye makeup with lots of purple in it, too. And they're wearing these sort of white, sort of sparkly bodysuits as well. So it's a very unusual look, to say the least.
It certainly is.
Yes, they use it with the women on the moon base consistently, all the time. The odd thing was that they used it all the time when they were on moon base, but when the same characters went to Earth, they lost the eye makeup and the purple wigs and suddenly had ordinary hair. And there was one case, I think just in one episode, where you had women walking around on moon base, but not when they were on duty, with ordinary hair. But the rest of the time, whether they were on or off duty, they had these purple wigs. And there were lots of odd things with the clothing, with these sort of knotted string shirts that some of the men would wear on moon base and on Skydiver as well, and they would show far too much through them. It was a very odd combination of different things that was obviously meant to be out there.
They do, yes. I mean, the uniforms worn by the shadow staff are very unusual. And as you've said, they're quite revealing. They reveal an awful lot of flesh. Because again, I think we're in classic, you know, television science fiction, that the certainly the women's costumes should be shiny and tight and revealing. And the moon base operatives, certainly that fits the bill. Which is, you know, it's all very nice because we've got Gabrielle Drake and some other very attractive women operating Moonbase. And then when we get to the submarine, when we get to Skydiver, we have them wearing, as you say, these rather ridiculous string vest outfits. And I mean, to be fair, they do, you know, this was a show that revealed as much of the sort of the male characters as it did of the female characters' anatomy. And unfortunately, this was very much the era of the hairy chest, wasn't it, Brian? There's an awful lot of male hair poking through these string
vests.
Yes,
that's true. There is, isn't there? At least when the women had the string shirts, they got to wear another shirt under
it,
right?
Yeah, the men didn't. And this certainly wasn't the era when men waxed or shaved. So it is quite amusing watching it now. There's also, I mean, Gabrielle Drake's character in one episode on the moon, where she's in her full purple wig and silver tight shiny outfit. They all wear these, they have these sort of silver boxes on their belts with the Shadow logo on them, which looks like some piece of technical equipment attached to their belt, and it's something important. And at one point in one episode, Lieutenant Gay Ellis, as she's called, takes her silver box off her belt, and I thought, we're going to see what piece of kit it is. And she opens it, and unfortunately it's a makeup compact in a mirror, and she adjusts her rather elaborate eye makeup, which was, I thought, slightly regrettable, having, you know, built them up as such competent and able female characters, and having them and falling back on them having them adjusting their makeup.
It was a little out of place in the sense that they had gone to some effort to have definite balance in the responsibilities of men and women. You had, you know, very responsible women and a control room on Earth in Shadow Headquarters with a real mix of men and women doing the same sorts of things and at all ranks and levels. And then when you went to Moonbase, all of the Interceptor pilots were men. All of the control room people were women, with the exception of one or two of the main characters, like Paul Foster. He was there for a time. But for the most part, you had these very definite separations on Moonbase, and the women were all with their makeup and the hair and this definite focus on that sort of thing. It was quite a contrast from what they had in the other Shadow locations.
Yes, it is strange. I mean, one of the things about UFO and the Shadow organization is that all the characters, all the staff seem to be multi-skilled. They can all do everything. They can all work every piece of kit. And so several of these sort of the main actors and actresses do different roles in different episodes. So in one episode, they'll be on Moonbase, and another episode, they'll be manning a submarine or similar. The only thing is, the Moonbase operatives in their purple wigs, we never see a man doing that job and having to wear a purple wig. It's always, as you say, three women running the control room in their distinctive outfits.
I would have loved to see a man wearing a purple wig in the Moonbase control room. There was a little while where Paul Foster was there, I think replacing Gay Ellis. So they would have a man there occasionally, but it was done very differently. He was never sitting in one of the chairs like the women were. It wasn't quite the same thing, for sure.
He gets to wear a very smart, shiny silver spacesuit, doesn't he?
Yes, he does. And I think Paul Foster was in just about every position they had at some point during the series.
Yep, absolutely. He flies the vehicles, he works on the sub, he works on Moonbase, he works on Shadow. He does everything. He flies an interceptor, I think, as well.
I think so. And flies Sky One.
Flies Sky One, yes. As well as the look of UFO, it also sounds very distinctive, and I think it sounds great. And in particular, the theme music and the opening credits sequence, which in a way will tell you everything you need to know about UFO. You can probably tell if you're going to like this series or not by watching the title sequence, which I suspect, in fact, I'm pretty sure you can watch on YouTube. It's got a very snappy sort of British science fiction theme music composed by Barry Gray, and it features clips in the opening sequences of all these characters and all these vehicles. So you get to see the full purple wigs, you get to see the interceptor pilots sliding down their sort of slides, which takes them to their vehicle, which is another sort of classic Gerry Anderson thing from Thunderbirds and Stingray and so on, that they have these sort of pilot transportation devices. Pilots don't just walk along to their X-wings or whatever and climb into them. They jump into chutes, or they stand against walls which rotate. And UFOs, no exception. We've got them all swinging down chutes to take them to the interceptors. So it's all there in the opening credits, really. The other thing is the actual sound effects they use, particularly for the UFOs. They came up with a very sort of alien, quite eerie and spooky sort of music, which is played whenever a UFO is moving through space or through the Earth atmosphere. And we get this weird sort of sound effect, which apparently, I'm reliably informed, was played on something called an Ondes Martinot, or an Ondes Martino, which is a very strange and quite rare electronic musical instrument, quite similar to a theremin.
It does sound a little bit like a theremin, that's true. You do have some early electronic instruments of that era coming up here. They use Hammond organ a fair bit, it seems. One of the things that I always enjoyed is not the title sequence itself, but the music that follows the title sequence is a great slow groove that has very much the feel of the James Bond theme. Personally, I usually don't like comparing things to other series and the like, but in this case, I have to say it. The Earth-based things have a lot of a James Bond feel to it in many cases. There is also something of a 1960s Star Trek feel. So if you can imagine 1960s Star Trek meets 1960s James Bond, UFO is right there. That's sort of what it does.
If you crashed James Bond into the original series of Star Trek, you'd get UFO. You know, they're very, you can certainly see elements in there. We've got the flashy cars, and we've got the flashy men flirting with receptionists and secretaries, and also doing secret agent stuff. And then we've got the science fiction elements, very similar to the original Star Trek. We've got these computers, which are largely just buttons, which aren't labeled, and people just press the buttons and they do things. We've got the commander, because Ed Straker, a bit like Captain Kirk, Ed Straker goes into action himself. He's not always to sit back and control things.
And he's a big talker. He speaks his mind.
He does speak his mind, yes. He likes to throw orders around. Perhaps, unfortunately, to the detriment of the show, it does have a bit of a Star Trek reset button at the end of every episode. There isn't an awful lot of continuity from one episode to another.
That's right. I thought that was disappointing, because it seemed like there were lots of opportunities to introduce something new into the show as they were going.
It does limit some of the potential of the show.
As we've said, UFO was created and produced by Gerry Anderson. Gerry Anderson, by this time, was already a big name in British science fiction and in science fiction children's television. Because by then, he had done a number of these Supermarionation shows, which were all aimed at children. They had lots of fancy vehicles and some of the things that we've described with UFO. There were lots of these things happening, and very much shows and stories and the like that were aimed at children. And he did quite a turnaround, because he never went back to Supermarionation. He did UFO. He later did another series called Space 1999, which was also live action. And much later, he did a live action series called Space Precinct. All of these live-action shows had a bit of the feel that they were trying to adopt an American style. You had Ed Bishop as Ed Straker in UFO as an American actor. And in the later series, like Space 1999, you had a number of American actors involved with American accents. That was definitely part of the style that was there. With Gerry Anderson being involved, his wife at the time was Sylvia Anderson. She was also heavily involved in this program, and I think a lot of the costumes and the visual look of it came down to Sylvia Anderson.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, she did the costumes for UFO, and she did the wigs. The purple wigs are down to her, apparently. She actually felt that wearing wigs would be much more common in the future, and that they might be used as part of military uniforms, which I think is where the moon base operatives idea came from.
Apparently, Sylvia Anderson did actually say that wigs would be part of military uniforms by 1980. I can't say where that came from, but apparently that's what she said. And many of the men also wore wigs. And she said that she thought wigs would become common for men as well. So apparently she was a great believer in wigs, where Gerry Anderson just said that they gave a futuristic look to it and looked good under the lighting they were using. There are some fans and the like who have suggested that maybe the wigs were used because of static electricity.
Right. Because of static electricity on the moon. Ah, okay.
Apparently.
Right, okay. I'm going to forgive Sylvia Anderson anything because she was Lady Penelope. So, as we've said, this was really the Andersons' first sort of combination of live action and model work. Previously, they'd just worked, I think, exclusively in puppetry and model work to produce this fantastic run of shows all the way through the 1960s. This was their first effort at a live action, and also, as Brian said, a very much a more adult show. It started off and was green lit at the end of the 60s. So they actually started shooting in 1969 when they'd been given the go-ahead by the sort of controller of independent television at that time, a very sort of influential figure called Lew Grade, who had a huge footprint on British television at the time. They started off with the regular cast, including adding in the Paul Foster character after the first few episodes. But unfortunately, the rest of the production didn't run quite so smoothly.
There was actually about a six-month production gap in the middle of the series, actually about two-thirds of the way through the series. Apparently, they decided to revise how they were doing things during that production gap because they came back with a series that was rather different from what they started with. And a number of the ideas that they had were very definitely changed and not the same as what they had earlier, and some of the cast members disappeared, and it took on a bit of a different style, and in some ways that worked well, in some ways it lost some of the interesting things that it had earlier on.
Yeah, that's right. They had, this is 26 episodes. It's just the one series, 26 episodes, with this sort of production gap about two-thirds of the way through. And as you say, some of the actors from the original production block don't return because they'd gone off to do other things, or their agent had told them they were in danger of being typecast. And so, for instance, George Sewell's character, Alec Freeman, who'd very much been Straker's number two, he doesn't come back. And then we get Colonel Virginia Lake, sort of being promoted to number two. And she takes a much bigger role in some of the later episodes.
With no real explanation about her new position and sort of real introduction into the series.
No, it's never explained. It's never explained why she's suddenly number two and Alec Freeman has disappeared. And the same, Lieutenant Gay Ellis, played by Gabrielle Drake on the moon, she disappears, not in the series. She's just not in it anymore. And so we have different characters. We have a character called Nina Barry, played by an actress, Dolores Mantes, and she seems to take on that role. And it is, as you say, it's slightly strange because the last third of the series is different.
And they didn't always get it right. Some of the things that they dropped and some of the things that they emphasized didn't really work that well in that last third of the series.
And the other interesting thing is because we've got 26 episodes, which are very much the standalone one-and-done type episodes, with, you know, as we've said, with a sort of reset button being pressed at the end of every episode, the result of that was that it was broadcast in an unusual order. So different TV companies in Great Britain broadcast the episodes in different orders. And I think the same happened when it was syndicated around the world.
That's right. Well, I think that covers it for the first half of our discussion of UFO. We will have plenty more to say about the details of UFO in the next episode of British Invaders. So this is Brian from Canada signing off.
And this is Eamon from England, not wearing a purple wig, but looking forward to talking more about them in the next episode.